last week, and what we did last week is you should all know that there's a document on Torah Focus regarding the spiritual realms. I think everybody has one. Maybe it owns Zebediah that does not, but it's in a PDF form. You can download it, and it's actually a document that we will fundamentally get to, because I want to talk about the essence of the spiritual realms and then the essence of your spiritual being a little bit. But we need to know and understand a couple things about spirituality, and we need to know some things about the spiritual realms. Okay? Now, in some literatures, and I'm talking, and it's not that I don't read often literature that is not Jewish. If I read literature, let's say it like this, if I read something that is not Jewish, it is at least on a scholarly level. So that means the people who are writing, they either have a doctor's degree or they're working towards a doctor's degree, etc. So they always have work that is put out that is usually heavily footnoted. Okay, and the reason that those that see my documents and my work on the Nazarene Codicil, and you say, why does he put all them those footnotes in there? Well, the footnotes are not, you know, to say, hey, look at all this business. But whenever you make a claim, whenever you say that something is this or something is like that, etc., the idea is to gather the information from the sages, so from the past, and then you interpret it and apply it to a particular piece of text. So all of the stuff that I've written, as far as you guys are just now, you're just going through the Peshat with Mark, but there's tons of Remez comments and commentaries as well. And those comments and commentaries are loaded with footnotes. And the reason that you have the footnotes is to prove the point that you're making, and to also show that the things that you're saying are not only just your idea, that they got fabricated somewhere out of the thin air. And so, you know, this sounds like a good theory, but I don't have any proof for it. And so, but I want you to believe it anyway. Well, that doesn't work in academic circles, and that doesn't work in Jewish circles, etc. So I actually had a guy that he was a messianic writer, let's put it that way, and he had some documents that he published, and he misquoted his sources. Now, the reason for me, the reason why this is important, is because sometimes some of those guys, they do that. That's what they do. Not specifically the Messianics, but people in general, they often misquote. And then when they misquote, what happens is you don't really have a source and you don't have a legitimate conversation in it. So I told this guy straight up, I said, you got one of two choices. I said, send me the data where that came from, the source, or take your article down off the web. And a couple days later, he sent me the source where it was from. So I say that because in Judaism, everything is based on the teachings of the sages. Okay? So last week, we began to discuss the four spiritual realms. I'm going to give them to you just quickly. If you haven't written those down, they're not on this document, I don't believe. No, they're not on the document. Okay. Okay, the first is called Atzilut, A-T-Z-I-L-U-T. teet, tee. Atzilut. And Atzilut is the realm, we'll just say it like this, the only one. I'm going to say it like this and then we'll break it down a little bit. First of all, it's the realm where God is. Nothing else. It's only the realm of God. It's so high, spiritually speaking, that only God can fill that realm. Now, also what we have when we begin to discuss spirituality and we begin to talk about, let's say, spiritual growth or education or elevation, the sages say that we've reached that particular realm, but it's not in the truest sense of that realm. It is in the manifestation of that realm, but on a much lower level. Okay, does that make sense? So on one level, so to speak, you can never reach it. But then on another more spiritual level, or on the spiritual level of explanation, there are attributes out of that that you can access. And that really becomes very difficult to try to explain, but nevertheless, it is very much the case. Okay, so for example, those of you who know the chart that we use of the 10 men of the congregation, you know that the upper level is called Keter, or the crown, and you basically are not supposed to ever reach that realm, but you do reach that realm because there are different levels of that. So you go through the primary level, and so then you go through Keter, and Keter becomes Malchut of the next stage or the next elevation, etc. And so this is very much the same way when we're talking about elevation and spiritual growth, okay? So Atzilut, first of all, is the realm of God, the God realm. The next realm is called Beriah, B-E-R-I-A-H, Beriah. And Beriah is it's associated with the word bara. So God created, in the beginning God created, bara, Bereshit bara, Elohim, etc. Okay, so that is the fundamental idea of creation. And that is sort of a pinpoint on creation, where creation begins. And then we go to the world of Yetzirah, and it is Y-E-T-Z-I-R-A-H, Yetzirah. And Yetzirah is the word for formed, like he formed Adam out of the dirt of the ground, etc. And then the last world is called Asaya, A-S-S-I-A-H, Asaya. Now, before we can fully understand the complexity of the human spirit, which is what is talked about in the document, and those particular things actually repeat themselves as you go through an educational process. Okay, let me just say it like this, okay? When you go to school, you do, of course we do kindergarten, and kindergarten kind of is a thing that doesn't really count, especially not now. But we did start learning things in kindergarten when we were in school, in kindergarten, for those of us who went to kindergarten. Okay, so you start off kindergarten, or first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade. And those particular subjects and that particular structure starts all over again. So then what you do is your fifth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade are mirrors of the first four levels, but they're on a higher level, on a higher plane. Okay? And then we go to high school, and we're doing freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior. Okay, so you have those repetitions of for in education, in almost every type of education. So even to this very day, they still fundamentally use those ideas of those four levels of education, okay? So one of the things about discussions concerning spiritual things is to start, and most people say, well, why don't we start like this, the grade school does, and let's start with the simple, and then we work our way toward the top. Well, we have fundamentally done that in the Torah Sederim, and the Torah Sederim start out with Peshat, and then they go, you know, successfully, they move upwards, and that's what we have done in the past. So right now, most of you are reading back through the Peshat. We don't have the Remez as a part of the structure, but right now what's happening, of course, is everything is being put into ironclad structure so that it will be for the future. Others will be able to follow it and see it, okay? So the interesting thing about spirituality is spirituality never starts at the bottom. It never starts at the first grade. It always starts at the very top, okay? So a way to explain this and a way to see it and understand it, that it does follow this pattern, is when you read in Shemot or the book of Exodus, you start to read about the construction of the Mishkan being the tabernacle. You would think that if you're going to start at, let's say, the Peshad level or the kindergarten level, first grade level, however you want to say it, that what you do is you would start at the outside and you would talk about the border that goes around the Mishkan. Now, what is not ultra clear to most people is that not only did you have a curtain that divided the outer portion from the inner portion. And when I say the outer portion, I will say basically like the secular area or the complete area around that camp. Although the camp was holy, there were outer portions that were not as sanctified as the inner portions. Okay, one major problem with people understanding the idea of holiness is that they do not understand that there are levels to holiness. Okay? So, for example, you could say that a person, let's just take the temple for example, a person who is standing in the outer court, he's in a sacred place, but he's not in the Holy of Holies. He's not in the most sacred place. And so, if he's Jewish, he moves from the court of the Gentiles or the outer courts, and then he moves into the courts, specifically of the women, and that is more sanctified, that court is more sanctified or holier, if you will, than the court of the Gentiles and the outside. And then there's a set of steps, 15 steps. You go up these 15 steps, and when you get up these 15 steps, you're in the court of the Israelites or the Jewish men, okay? And then that moves from another level of the Jewish men, and it goes to the court level of the Kohanim or the priests. And then it goes up another level, and then you go into the temple itself, and you're in those courts, you've gone up again, and then you've elevated to that spiritual level. And then when we come to the level of the Holy of Holies, it's not an increase of elevation, but an area that is basically curtained off, that is the holiest of all places in the cosmos. So in holiness, what happens is there's elevation. And so when we start off talking about these four worlds, the lower level would be Asaya, the world of building or making. Asaya basically means like to make, to build something. And then you would go up to Yetzirah, which is the world of formation. And then from formation, you would go to Beriah, which is the place of creation. And then the highest realm that you could go to, of course, is Atzilut, the realm of God. Okay? But when God started talking about the tabernacle, he did not start in the outer courts. He started from the Holy of Holies, and then he began his work, and he moved outward from the Holy of Holies. So the first things he begins to talk about is the Ark of the Covenant, and how it's constructed, etc., etc. Then he moves to the curtains that separate the Holy of Holies from the holy place. And then once you come out of the curtains, now let me tell you, most people think there are more than, or not more than one curtain. When they say that there's a barrier between the Holy of Holies and the holy place, they only think there's one curtain. That is not true. There are two. Okay, so the two curtains are about, let's say, almost 3 feet wide. Okay, the corridor that goes between the two curtains. So when the high priest would go into the Holy of Holies, he was carrying incense and those types of things that he would carry in with the blood. And then he would go, if you're facing the curtain, he would go to the far left of the curtain, which would be to the south. And then you would go to the south end of the curtain, and there would be one curtain. They're both the same length, but they're not hung at the same length. So one curtain would be hung off center by nearly 3 feet. So what you would do, go all the way to your left, and then you take your elbow and you hook the curtain, and you turn yourself back to the north, and then you walk down the corridor between the two curtains, and then the curtain on the inner side is the same way. So it is positioned about 3 feet to the left of the outer curtain. So then when you're going to turn and go into the Kodesh Kodeshim, or the Holy of Holies, you hook the curtain with your left elbow, and then you turn and you walk in to the Holy of Holies. Okay? So there are two curtains. Now, many times people think, and you'll find a lot of people that are ignorant of the construction of those curtains and ignorant of the construction of the barriers between the Holy of Holies and the holy place. And it talks in the Nazarene Codicil, and it tells you where that a veil was rent. And most people think that the veil that was rent was the one between the holy place and the Holy of Holies. And so it rips the curtain, and then you can see into the Holy of Holies. This is absolutely not true, because it does not say that the curtains, plural, ripped, and then you could see into the Holy of Holies. But it talks about a curtain that is like the heavens. And that curtain hung in the upper portion of the temple. Okay, so it's hanging from the ceiling, and it's going throughout the top of the ceiling. And part of the reason why you had that was because there were times when the inner court and the very inner court had to be cleaned. And so they would enter this, not through the regular way, but through the upper portions of the temple, and they would clean and do mechanical work there, etc. whatever work it needed. Okay, so the curtain that actually was rent was up above. It was not between the two places. So when God begins his work of creation, his creation work, he begins with where he is at. And then eventually everything is unfolded piece by piece until it gets to what we would call the world where everything is created, not just created, but formed. Okay? And it takes on that vocabulary from God formed Adam out of the dust of the ground, etc. And then he breathed into his nostrils, it says, the breath of life. Okay? Literally lives. But that's always how life is said. Chaim. More than one. Okay? Now, suppose for a minute, hopefully you can imagine with me that you're God, and so for you, now the problem is to try to imagine something existing solely by itself for no mandated length of time. So you're looking in some respects into an eternal past. And so you're looking, and that's where God is. Okay, but now we need to differentiate between gods for a minute. Okay, so when you read the Torah, it starts off with Elohim. And then by the time you come to chapter 2, verse 7, it says, in most translations, it says the Lord God. Now, some people will write this as Jehovah or Yahweh or whatever they want to try to say. But the Ramban says and calls him the eternal God. And so that is the best way to understand that idea of the four-lettered name of God, which is the Yud He and the Vav He. And it actually means someone who is basically self-existent. Okay, so he exists by himself, nothing created him, etc. But now you have him, and we cannot possibly begin to realize or think about how he thought, how he did anything. We cannot fathom that. Because in one sense of the word, you and I, we think. And when we think, one thought comes after another. Okay? You think like, I need to take a shower. Then I need to shave. Then I need to brush my teeth. Or whatever order that you do it in. But in your mind, you say, I'm going to. And you think this process out. With Hashem, the process isn't a process of one thing happening after another when we first understand and start to think about God. Now later, it will come to a point where in some sense we have to try to think of things in some form of time, but we don't understand how to apply this time to God. Okay, so how do you say that the eternal had a thought? And then from that thought, he went from that thought to the process of creation. Okay? So, the point begins, and the whole sum of everything that we know is that what God began, when he begins his process of creation, he has one motive. Only one thing that he determines to do. Okay? And this is the purpose, the plan, no matter how you read it. This is the point. And that point is that God wanted to pour goodness out on something other than himself. So it is therefore, as we said before, it is therefore, if you want to be like God, and he says in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 2, he said, "Be holy because I am holy." Holy means to be dedicated to a particular cause. So being holy and then being holy like God means to be committed to the same exact cause that he is committed to. Are you with me? Okay, so if he said that my choice and my dedication of whatever resources, however you want to say this, my dedication is a dedication to putting good on something other than myself. Not being selfish, but thinking of others and trying to do good for them. So when it's said and done, no matter what kind of hell you might be going through in your life, some way or another, it is all for the sake of finding good. Now, it's very easy in our day and age to look and say, now, wait a minute. If God's ultimate goal is to make absolute good for everyone, then how come the world seems so evil? Has anybody else ever come up with that thought besides me? You're looking and you're going, why in the world does it have to be like that? You watch TV, and if you watch TV, there's either, you know, absolute cursing or violence or nudity or allusions to whatever that could happen, you know, anything. And it used to be, you know, semi-subtle, but now it's just to throw this right in your face. And here, you deal with it, and it makes everyone think that, you know, like, you're the problem. I'm not the problem because I'm different and I'm breaking out of those bounds. I'm not the problem. You're the problem because you don't think that this is okay. Well, I got a problem. So that's how that goes. Okay, so the pinpoint of absolute beginning is this choice of God to create a realm or a place to where that he could pour out goodness on mankind. And we'll say it like that. Now we have a great problem because even though each of us have some minuscule part of the divine presence as an essence, let's say that it's inside of us, no matter how it might be. And if you could just take the point of a pin, and when I'm talking about a pin, I'm saying the like a pin that the ladies use for pinning things together in their sewing. And if you could look at the pinpoint of that pin and then say, somewhere in my body, there's this infinitesimally small point, and that point is the divine element in me. It's inside of you. And so when you see this, and then you think that God has to break down these four different worlds so that it comes down to a place that we can actually have an interaction with God, because his holiness, let's say, or his essence is so high that it is absolutely not possible for us to fathom him in that nature, in that essence. He's absolutely beyond full comprehension. So, you know, there is an idea in the Torah that the Torah is, it begins with the letter bet. Okay, why does it begin with the better letter bet? And the sages say, it, you know what it looks like. It's kind of the backward C, more or less, sort of. And then from that point, we know Hebrew is reading from right to left. And so the sages say, when you come to this point right here in Bereishit, you can't get on this side because you're on the inside of that letter and you can't go. So there's a saying among the sages that says, you know, there are certain things that you're forbidden to think about. And some of the things that they say that you are forbidden to think about is what happened before creation. But what are we doing this evening? Are we talking about things that happened before creation? Yes, no, you don't think so? You do think so? Wait a minute, 1 second. I think my... Now you can talk.
We do. We're talking about from before creation because we're talking about God.
Okay.
And we're also talking about his purpose.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Was before creation.
Right. Oh, you said what did you say? His purpose what?
Was before creation.
Ah, before creation. Okay. So he has this purpose, but beyond that, we can't see beyond that. Because we don't know him. And it's not possible to know that. So all we know is that at some juncture, and you can't say time, but we'll just say at some point, he said, okay, I'm going to do this. But we don't know what was beyond that. So that's the point of creation. And we cannot see or know beyond that point. Okay. Yeah, we can read the physical portions of the Torah, and then we can say, well, these things happened, and that's what we're doing, we're discussing. But there's a point there that we cannot go beyond that point. Because right now, even if we were at the highest level that we're talking about right now, we cannot fathom God in that realm. It is not possible. And I've taught you this. He does many times, and this is exampled in Genesis 15, Bereishit 15, where he's speaking and he's dealing with Abram. And when he's dealing with Abram, it says that, you know, he tells Abram, you know, let's make a sacrifice. And so they start the sacrifice, and the sacrifice is these animals, and he splits them down the middle, and he's in the middle of these particular sacrifices. And then it says God comes, but it says on a horror of darkness. So it's one of those darknesses that is absolutely so dark that there is no possibility of any type of light. And you can say, oh, I can see this little speck of light here or whatever, but it being in a place of absolute 100% darkness. And God does that, and the reason God does that is so that he can come close, but you cannot see him. And he makes it so his presence can come so close to us, but we can't see him, but nevertheless he's present. And so he uses darkness as this absolute mechanism so that he can draw close. But even on the spiritual realms, let's say, even darkness has some form of a light. Okay? So, what we call the things that come out of, let's say, God's mind in this process of creation are called emanations. E-M-A-N-A-T-I-O-N. Emanation. So there are emanations of God or his activity or his outgoing process of making it to where that humanity can receive this goodness from him. Okay? So, the first thing God does is he creates, again here, if you could imagine the immensity of the entire cosmos And we cannot even fathom the depth of this, albeit though I think last week we talked and we said that Einstein tried to prove that the cosmos was infinite, but in fact he proved that it was finite. And I told you that it is in conal shape. And it is continuing to move outward, and in according to science, which sometimes I think is accurate, and the other times I think they don't have the first clue, but I'm not a scientist, so I can't have to, and I don't have to answer those questions, etc. But the thing is that with science, science tries to understand these things, but they can't understand these things because they're not thinking from a God perspective, okay? And so this point, they don't understand why it's conal, and they don't know why it's moving so fast. And so I've said in the past, that's because God speaks. And when God speaks, it goes out of his mouth, and sound continues. Sound continues. It does not stop. Once it's gone out of the mouth, it never ceases. It's always in some form of substance. Okay? Now, you know, maybe you don't know, if you study some of Einstein, and I'm not the student of Einstein, so I can't explain this fundamentally more than beyond what I will say, and that is that sound can turn into matter. Okay? And in one essence, this is what happened. But imagine in all of the cosmos, there's one little finite point. Look at that needle pin again and say, this is what God created. Something so minuscule that, you know, even to this very day, they don't have microscopes that can see anything that would be that finite. But God created that simple small dot. And then out of that dot, let's call that the primordial matter. Okay, so that is the essence of all of creation from this one little minuscule element that he created. Now, it has different names throughout, and the Ramban calls it by a Greek name, Heli, or something of that nature. I'm not interested in searching out that vocabulary right now because it's a Greek term and it's not a Hebrew word. But at the point of God creating this finite micro dot, something else emanates from that dot. It is the first thing that begins to come out of something that God created. Okay, so understand this. God, however he did it, he made this minuscule dot, and that dot would be the matter for all of creation. And then, because this is the seed of creation, boom, everything begins to come out of it. The first emanation, the greatest of all of the emanations, and the point that you never will understand, and if you do, I'll sit in the back of the class and listen and be happy to be there. This emanation is called Chokhmah, or wisdom. Now, it's wisdom, and it's like this. From this point forward, everything is enclosed in that minuscule creation. And then Chokhmah is like the seminal point of procreation. So you begin with, you have love. So we have the love of God saying that he's going to create something for humanity. And so in one sense, to use our imagination, and we can do this in Zoetic ideas, we can consider humanity God's lover. And so God's lover and God, and of course we're speaking in visionary terms and non-literal terms, but God decides that he's going to make love to his lover. And then, as is the case with those actions, the final part is an insemination with millions of seed. I don't know if we give out millions or thousands or what, but just for the sake of the conversation, we're talking about God, so there's millions of possibilities. So, out of that one minuscule emanation of wisdom, everything is created. So you can say that when God made the giraffe and he made it with a long neck, I don't care whether you think it looks funny or not. He used wisdom to make it. And it is made in that way for a very specific reason. The same as the elephant, the lion, the tiger, the ant, the whatever. They are all created that way very much for a very specific cause. Okay, so creation begins then with a primal emanation. And the primal emanation, before we get to wisdom, I call it the God idea. Everybody understands that, right? Okay. So, you know, Genesis, when you start reading, it says, in the beginning, God. No explanation, no definition, no rules, no explanatory commentary. Just in the beginning, God. But we don't know the first thing about God. And everyone here, the God that you think about has been something that you have constructed in your mind over the years of your life. So God has been shaped in your mind in a very specific way by your studies, your thoughts, whatever it might be. But I would venture to say that in this group at the present, none of us see God as the same thing or see him in the very same way. Each one of us has a concept of God that is a concept that we can try to the best of our extent we can fathom. This is how you know God. You understand God from this. And so you might call him the creator, the healer, the whatever it is that you might call him. And you might even say he's the immanent one, the high one, the lofty one. He's the ancient of days. Even the Bible goes way out of its way to use what we call anthropomorphisms. And the anthropomorphism is that we see God as if he were a man. And it's almost impossible to not see God in that very way. And one of the things His Eminence Rabbi Hillel will do to you is something that he and I both learned from Rabbi Akiva Tetz, and I'm sure you've probably heard him talk about it, Rabbi Akiva Tetz. I know many of you have listened to his lectures. But Rabbi Akiva Tetz says, you know what? He says, does God have an arm? And the first thing you say, no, God doesn't have an arm. But the truth is, God's the only one with an arm. And we don't understand what an arm is, but we have an arm. And the reason we have this arm is so we can realize in some finite way that God does things with his hands, so to speak, whatever they might be, and we cannot fathom exactly what they should be. So, you know, if you were a fly in somebody's house and the person didn't like flies, so you see this gigantic hand coming and it squats this fly and smashes it into smithereens. Some people, that's the way they see God. He's up there waiting to smack them on the back of the head. Okay, but the emanation of God is this thing that I call it the God idea. So, where did your imagination come up with the God that you know and believe in right now? I don't have an air. I think you got your mic muted.
Yeah, I did. The pinpoint.
Say it again, the pinpoint?
The pinpoint.
Okay. Actually, you're right on. But what did the pinpoint say? What did it contain? What did it whatever? And so out of the pinpoint is this wisdom. But this wisdom is actually a picture of God, in a sense. It would be, as we said, seminal. So it would be multitudes and multitudes of seed. And so you can have a vision, I can have a vision. They're with the same God, but they're different perspectives on God. Okay? But it was God who came up with the idea to make an idea about himself so that his people could see him and think about him. He had to create something called the God idea, as it were, an image of himself. So this is kind of like, you know, the guys that are stars and stuff like that. You know, they've built an image of themselves. This guy always in the movies, he plays a tough guy. This guy always plays whatever, okay? So, you know, when they say a certain character is going to play in a movie, you see the character who's playing the movie. You know about it. You think, well, he's going to play Mr. Tough Guy or he's going to play whatever. Okay, so God initially creates this thing. This is called the God idea. And the God idea, people have been studying it. They've been trying to understand it, etc. Okay, so forgive me, I'm not trying to belittle any religion, but, you know, Christianity has this idea of theology. And theology is to try to capture the God idea, to put it down into a little box, because we don't like things that we can't understand. And so let's just say that he can do this. He's omnipotent, or he's omnipotent, meaning he's all powerful. Wait. Power is a tool of God. It's not God. It's a tool that God uses. But it is not God. Okay? You say he's omniscient. He's all-knowing. No. He created knowing, knowledge, wisdom, understanding. He created that as a tool. And you say he's omnipresent. No, he's beyond omnipresent. We can't understand it. But he created those things as tools so that we could understand and have a relationship with him. But he is not confined by any one of those things. So the God that we serve, we keep trying to grasp him. But the way that Judaism speaks about it is that we have to have a no theology policy when it comes to God. So you cannot box God into a particular dimension or hole and try to say that's God. Let's go to a Bible verse. And then we'll get started with the lesson. Exodus chapter 33. Verse 13, I think, is where we're going to start. Okay, this is Moshe. And he's speaking to God. I think we may have discussed or talked about this a little bit last week. Verse 13, now therefore I pray, if I have found chesed in your sight, show me yourself, that I may know you, and that I may find chesed in your sight, and that I might consider the nation that is your people. And he says, Hashem says, the eternal God says, my presence will go with you. And it actually doesn't say with, it said, well, go, and I will give you rest. And he's like, no, wait a minute, this is not what I'm saying. And he says, if your presence does not go with us, but not bring us up from here, he said, for then how will we be known as your people? And he said, if I find grace in your sight, he said, go with us so that we can be separate, your people, I, from all of the people of the foundations of the world, of the face of the world. And the Lord said to Moshe, he said, I will also do this thing which I have spoken. He said, and you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name. He said, please show me your glory, Moses is saying. And he said, I will make my goodness go before you, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord. So here he's saying he pronounced the name of the 72 letters before you. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious. And I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. But he said, you cannot see my face, for no man will see me and live. And the eternal God says, here is my place by me. Here there is a place. Place in Hebrew right here is makom. It means like an eternal empty place. A place where that is filled with the divine presence. He said, and you will stand on a rock. The rock is a picture of Messiah. He said, so it will be with my glory passes by you. I will put you in the cleft of the rock. I will wedge you in a rock. So he's standing on a rock. He's pushed into the rock, into the cleft, and I will cover you with my hand. Why does he say hand? Because hand represents activity. Okay? And so he's talking, I will cover you with my hand or my works, and then I will take away my hand, and you will be able to see my back. But my face you will not be seen. So what does he say? And how is it that he sees his back? What has that got anything to do with seeing God, understanding God, and coming to a closer awareness of who and what he is? The answer is not ultra complex. Because what it really says to us is that you will see my back, or you will see my history. What is my history? The things that I have done. So only by knowing the history of God can you come to know him. So we can only go back to the point of where he started with a single idea that he would bring humanity into existence. And then once he had brought all these things into existence, then after that, he will take us to a place which will be his. But he starts off with the first thing that we call the God idea. The God idea are all the things that he created so that we could come to awareness of who he is, what he is. And we probably would struggle to go farther than to understand that we will not know what, even to us, that he will become.